and welcome to Talking Aussie Books, a weekly podcast bringing readers and writers of Australian fiction together. I'm Claudine Tennellis. As an avid reader and passionate advocate for Australian fiction, I make it my mission to spotlight local talent. So if you're looking for your next read or simply want to learn more about the Australian literary scene, this podcast is for you. Grab yourself a cuppa, sit back and relax.
This episode is brought to you by HarperCollins Publishers Australia.
Well, listeners, it's another day and another chance to speak to an award-winning Aussie author. Today, it's Veronica Lando. Veronica is a crime writer who burst onto the Australian literary scene a couple of years ago when her then unpublished manuscript won the 2021 Banjo Prize. That manuscript, called The Whispering, was published by HarperCollins in 2022 to much critical acclaim. Earlier this month, Veronica's second book, The Drowning Girls, was published. And if it's anything like The Whispering, I can see why Veronica's literary star is well and truly on the rise. Dark, tense, and twisty, this book was as atmospheric as it was creepy. A story of small-town secrets underscored by the ever-present menace of a hostile landscape. Utterly captivating, and I'm thrilled to finally have the chance to chat with Veronica on the podcast today. Hi, Veronica.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm very excited to be here and, to talk all things Aussie books and the Drowning Girls in particular.
Fantastic. Well, Veronica, we were talking a little bit about this before we started recording, but haven't you been a busy bee the last few years? Three children under five, an award-winning manuscript and a three-book deal to boot. I'm in complete awe of you. So congratulations.
Thank you so much. Oh, look, it's been wild. Last year in particular was a very tough year. So I had my third daughter was born last year in March, and then the book, The Whispering, my first book, came out in July. And so I had pretty much a newborn baby when that book came out. And that's actually the same time that I wrote The Drowning Girls. So I wrote The Drowning Girls in those sort of snatches of time between breastfeeds and the wee hours of the morning. And so it's been an absolute roller coaster. I think, you know, there's that old saying that when it rains, it pours. And you probably never choose to publish your first book and have a baby simultaneously, but they sort of just both happened at the same time, and you're never going to say no to a publishing deal. So, we sort of had to roll with it, but it was a very tough year. I'm glad actually to say goodbye to 2022.
It's no mean feat to have three children under five and give birth and try and get a book out. I mean, that's just really incredible. As I said, completely awestruck by your achievements.
Thank you so much. They are getting older now. Now I have to sort of say three children under six. So it doesn't have the same ring. People don't give me the same sort of sympathy looks when I say three children under six. Three children under five sounds much more impressive.
I think so too, but I think it's still very impressive. So, Veronica, I wonder if you could tell me about your decision to enter the Banjo Prize and what getting that phone call meant to you.
Well, the decision was, I was aware that the Banjo Prize was a thing and it was on my horizon, and I had written two drafts of The Whispering, my debut book, and I sort of was at the stage where I was looking into literary agents and publishers, and I was aware of these competitions that go on for unpublished manuscripts, but I thought that my book actually wasn't up to scratch yet. It was only, as I say, I'd only done two drafts. There was still a lot of work I wanted to do on it and that I thought it needed to really be polished. I had read from some previous winners that their book was really polished before they submitted it to the competition. So I had thought actually I wouldn't submit it that year. I'd wait 12 months and go for the following year. And then just by pure luck, I was listening to an interview with Catherine Milne, one of the HarperCollins fiction editors, and I listened to it about, I think it was on a Tuesday that I listened to it, and she spruiked the Banjo Prize, which was closing on the Friday, so a few days from then. And she sort of said, look, you've got to be in it to win it and you have nothing to lose. She's like, you just send us your manuscript, we'll have a read, and what's the worst that's going to happen? Nothing. And so I was like, oh, after listening to that a couple of days before the competition closed, I went, right, I'm going to do it. She said just to do it. So I didn't have time to edit it in those few days. I was working. I had two kids. at that stage. And so I tidied it up. I formatted it and skimmed it for spelling errors and typos, and I sent it off at the 11th hour. I think I sent it off at like sort of 11 o'clock at night on the Thursday, and it closed at 5 p.m. on the Friday, but I had work or other commitments on that day, so I wouldn't be able to work on it. So it was really a last minute decision. I just sort of threw it in there, expected nothing to come of it. And then getting the phone call to find out that I was shortlisted was phenomenal. We had just moved town from Brisbane to Townsville. So we'd been in a very, very big turmoil stage of our family's life. And we just also found out that I was pregnant with our third child. So we had these two really big things that happened within that sort of month beforehand, the big move and baby number three on her way. And I remember we had been on a road trip up to Cairns, and we were driving back to Townsville. It's about a 5-hour drive, and we'd stopped at an ice cream shop with our younger kids to get a treat on the way. And I was in the car park by myself at the ice cream shop. I will always remember it. And I listened to the voicemail, which I had missed because I was driving, so I hadn't answered the phone when they had called. So I was listening to this voicemail, and it was the lady that is now my publisher, Annabelle Dinger, who's glorious in every possible way. And she was just saying that I had been shortlisted for the banjo, that they loved The Whispering. And she said all these delightful things that no one had ever said about my writing. And it was such a validation of what I had been doing for years. You know, when the kids go to bed and I would just write away, it was just so sort of comforting and exciting to hear that there was something in it. And I was must have been jumping around the car park, because this couple stopped on their way back to their car and actually asked me if I had won the lotto. And I was like, at the time I was like, no, it's much more exciting. I wrote a book and there's a publisher and she likes it. And they sort of nodded along. They didn't quite get the sort of, how big the situation was. So it was the most delightful, delightful voice message. It was a voice message. And then I called her back and we had a wonderful chat.
Oh, I think that is just the best story. Actually, it's not unlike Janooka McKenzie's story, the previous Banjo Prize winner, who told me that she also got a voicemail message from Anna Valdinger. That was hilarious.
The beauty of the voicemail message is you can save it and re-listen to it. Indeed. And make all your family and friends listen to it.
Indeed. Oh, kudos to you. So, Veronica, how has winning the banjo changed your life?
Oh, it's hugely, absolutely hugely. It sort of transitions you from being someone who writes in secret and writes very much as a hobby. It's considered a hobby, even if you are aiming to get published and you're taking yourself seriously. It moves you from that realm to being a published author who has contracts and deadlines, and you are then happy to tell everyone. All your friends can know now that you write, and it's not something you just secretly do that only your partner knows about. It's a real confidence boost. It gives you that validation that it actually is worth it, and all the hard work and the hours and then late nights that you've been putting in have paid off. But it's definitely changed in that I now, since we relocated up to Townsville, I didn't go back to my job in health immediately when we first got up here, which I would have done had I not won the banjo. Instead, I've been able to focus on the children, but also on the writing. I will go back to sort of my health job next year and do a little bit of part-time work. But for now, it's been nice to have this year and last year with not having the pressure of needing to return to part-time work in that respect. And so I can sort of, I guess that's the mental, my sort of mental load is slightly less because of that. It still feels immense though. But I can focus more on my writing and not have to worry about that other side of things for now, because it is, you know, you're trying to forge out a bit of a career in that direction.
Yeah, fantastic. So I wanted to know, when you won the banjo, had you already written a second manuscript?
No, not at all. So I had, I wrote The Whispering very quickly at the tail end of 2020, the last couple of months. It took me about 3 months and I finished to write it, the first draft, and I finished it just before Christmas. And then I spent the first few months of 2021 editing it, doing my second draft. And then the banjo prize was, I think it was in May maybe, that it closes. And so I only had my second draft and just sort of fired that off. And I had my whole head was in that first book, and I hadn't even contemplated a second book. And I knew from hearing other authors be interviewed that as soon as they submitted, or, you know, their first book had been accepted for publication, that the next question that they got asked was always, so tell us about book two. So I knew I had to come up with something. So the second book wasn't really written at all until the following year, until just the first half of last year, really. So, yeah, at the time that The Whispering was picked up and I won the banjo, there was no thoughts for book two.
Yeah, interesting. How would you compare writing The Whispering versus The Drowning Girls? What was that process like?
Yeah, quite different. The Whispering was very much a passion project. I loved it. I loved every second of it. It was my me time. It was the first book I ever wrote. There was no pressure at all from anyone. Most of my friends and family members didn't even know that I was writing. My husband knew, but that was pretty much it. And so there was no expectation. There was no one asking me about it. It didn't matter if it didn't get published. I wanted it to get published, but it wasn't going to be a case of me sort of feeling like a bit of a failure if it didn't make it out there because no one knew. Whereas with the second book, there was pressure. I was writing it, or I was pitching it rather, I was out of contract. So I was pitching it to try and sell it to my publisher. And so that was very stressful. And there was a very different process because I had to put together a pitch package. So I had to sort of have the synopsis ready to roll prior to even writing the book. And I had to really polish my first sort of few chapters, sort of the first 10,000 words I'd written, and then I had to rewrite and rewrite and rewrite and make them fabulous before we sent that off to the publisher. So that was very different. Whereas the Whispering, I just wrote from chapter one all the way through to the end, and it was all very sloppy in that first draft, which was fabulous. And so, yeah, The Drowning Girls was quite a different process. And then, as I say, I had this newborn baby. So I was writing in this sort of stage of life where you're really tired. And your mind's not quite there, but I think it's paid off because I've been told it by a few people they liked it better than The Whispering, and that also I've been told that it's a bit of a darker story, but I suspect that could be because I was so tired.
I think there's actually a few reasons why it's a dark story, but that, yeah, I absolutely think that probably is one of them. Okay, so let's talk about the Drowning Girls. Can you tell me about your inspiration for the book? Is there really a thing such as the Drowning Girl Festival, or is this just a figment of your very overactive imagination?
It's thank goodness there's not a thing as the Drowning Girl Festival. How morbid if there
I know,
was.
it would be horrifying.
So for listeners, the Drowning Girl Festival is this sort of like annual festival run by this town, little tiny town in far north Queensland, and they sacrifice a woman to the sea in order to ensure a prosperous fishing haul. And if they don't, the seas will dry up and the industry that supports the town will collapse. But it is all just a legend and it's not a real woman and whatnot. But no, it's thank goodness it's not a real festival. But I love the idea. I love morbid things and a little bit macabre. And I really like the idea of a whole group of people, almost like that mob mentality, a whole group of people behind this really twisted concept and sort of supporting this idea of sacrificing someone to the cause, sacrificing someone for the greater good. I loved that. I thought it's quite sickening to think that as a group of collectively if people get together, maybe seemingly normal people, but when you're all thrust into this situation that you can sort of just get a bit carried away with it all. So I really liked that idea. And then the inspiration for it, a lot of it came from the setting. I loved coming up with the settings early on in my sort of planning. And I live in Townsville and we're fortunate in that we live right near the foreshore and I walk regularly along the waterfront. And it's very sort of mud flat and mangrovey up here for anyone that hasn't been and isn't aware of it. So it's sort of a tidal ocean. And so you'll have times where the ocean's out and you've just got mud flats. So it looks like forever. And I was, walking along and I was like, oh, of course, this is such a great spot. The mangroves in particular are quite menacing. They're twisty roots. I feel like you could hide anything in there. And then we do also have up here this beautiful, it's a very cute little jetty that we have in Townsville. And sort of not on the jetty, but just off the side in the water, there's this statue of a woman. She's called the Ocean Siren and she lights up at night time and changes colours depending on the colour of the coral reef. And I was watching her one night. I was sitting on the grass watching where the jetty is and watching the statue change colours. And I just had this image of the jetty with the woman perched at the end. And I thought she can be the Drowning Girl. Yeah, it sort of all stemmed from that. So very much a lot of the inspiration came from my hometown of Townsville and just the general sort of the setting around here and the landscape around here.
Yeah, fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Okay, so for those who haven't read it yet, can you tell us a little bit more about the story?
Yeah, so the story follows Nate, who is a disgraced school teacher. He's in a little bit of trouble down south and he heads reluctantly up north to the tiny fishing town of Port Flinders. And he's gone up there to fill in the supply teaching role for the first term at the little primary school. And he arrives right on the cusp of Port Flinders' annual Drowning Girl Festival. Not too long after he arrives, the body of a real woman actually washes up on the shore. And so while the Drowning Girl Festival is really about sacrificing a fake woman. It's all just a gimmick and a legend. After this woman actually shows up drowned, you know, Nate starts to wonder if there's a little bit of truth behind the legend, or wonders what's going on. It all looks a little bit suspicious, and he finds out that he has a little bit of a connection to the woman. And so he feels really compelled to find out what's happened to her, because no one seems that concerned. The authorities aren't that concerned as to what's gone on. It's that she's been deemed as probably being drunk and just sort of fallen off the jetty, and she's drowned, unfortunately. And, you know, let's all just wipe our hands clean of her. And Nate does a little bit of digging and starts to sort of look into things. And he finds this quite unsettling truth that there's been a number of deadly accidents over the years. Mm-hmm. So there's been quite a lot of deaths in years past. And he finds that they're actually all women that have died, and they've all drowned. And they've all drowned during the time of the festival in rather suspicious circumstances. And so Nate finds himself wondering if perhaps there are some people in Port Flinders that do actually believe in the legend of the drowning girl, and do think that a woman does need to be sacrificed in order to ensure this sort of prosperous year of fishing ahead. And if perhaps maybe there's someone that is taking the sacrifices into their own hand.
What an incredible and unique story. I really was marveling at your skill in writing this story and weaving all of these different threads into the narrative. It got me thinking about fishing towns, which are historically superstitious or perhaps overly reliant on higher powers for good fishing and the safety of their fishing fleet. I mean, you don't need to look very far to uncover annual blessings of the fleet ceremonies throughout the world for this very purpose. But the drowning girls, I think, Veronica, explore some deeper, less romantic views around the waxing and waning of the fortunes of the fishing industry, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I think it does sort of draw attention to the struggles of that industry and the struggles that towns that rely solely on that industry that they experience. And so it does sort of tries to shine a little bit of light on that as well. And then it sort of links in with the superstition that the townsfolk believe that this, you know, whether or not they're prosperous or not with their year of their haul for the year comes down to whether or not they've actually sacrificed someone or not.
Was this something that you were concerned to delve into before you actually started writing, or was this a sort of subject that came to light as you were in the midst of writing the book?
Definitely came to light as I was writing the book. It wasn't sort of my focus. I didn't set out to sort of explore that at all, that sort of theme. I read for entertainment, and so I write to entertain my readers. So that definitely wasn't something that was there. I don't sort of want to try and be sort of didactic in my writing at all. And yeah, it was something that it was as I was writing and well into the book that I was like, oh, actually, we're talking, you know, a lot about things that actually are a real issue for a lot of small towns and businesses, and, you know, there's a real reliance on this industry. So yeah, that definitely came to light with the writing of the book. It wasn't a planned theme.
Yeah. So to that end, did you do any particular research to bring this issue to light on the page?
I did do some. It was mostly done just with good old Google, but I found myself looking into really what things can affect the fishing industry and what can make for a bad haul, a lot of environmental factors, and what in particular what environmental factors might lead to it. So there was a little bit of research done, and it was quite odd because it was research I hadn't planned on as I was writing. I was like, oh, this is a really strange area for me to be personally for me to be researching. It felt quite odd, but definitely yes, I had to. I didn't really understand the industry that well, and so as I was writing and these sort of story elements were cropping up, I was like, oh, I don't actually know what I'm doing here, so I'd have to jump online and have a little bit of a dig around.
The life of a crime writer, right?
Yes. One of the nicer things I've researched, though, you do find yourself Googling some really, really morbid and twisted things.
I bet. Veronica, you paint a pretty somber picture of life in Port Flinders. The heat, the humidity, the tidal mud flats, and the claustrophobic presence of the mangroves. I mean, it's not the idyllic coastal community or pretty fishing village, is it?
Not at all, no. It's not particularly pleasant up there. And I think also because they are a struggling town financially, Nate refers to them as the town that should have, you know, fallen off the map a long time ago. So everything, unfortunately, is very sort of dilapidated and run down. And then also the environment, it's incredibly harsh. It's hot, it's humid. You know, the water's not friendly. You can't swim in the waters up there. There's, you know, jellyfish and crocs and all sorts of things that you need to be wary of. It would be soupy anyway if you did get in. And yes, I love a harsh environment. I love reading about harsh environments as well. And I think that can really shape your characters in particular. So they end up reacting to the environment. And because of that, it helps with driving the plot a lot. So I do like, as I think I mentioned earlier, I love coming up with my settings but very early on in my sort of idea or planning process for a book. And I love then using that setting to shape the characters and as a result, shape the plot and to sort of really propel the story.
You mentioned that you were inspired by your hometown of Townsville, but Port Flinders is obviously a fictional place. So in your mind, was it Townsville when you were writing about it, or had you kind of thought somewhere that had some characteristics of Townsville, but mostly fictional traits?
No, I wasn't thinking of Townsville as I wrote it at all. I was picturing two places. So I was picturing Corumba, which is the little town up in the Gulf of Carpentaria. I want to say it's Sunset Tavern up there where you sit and you can have your beer out on the sand and the sun sets over the ocean. And so I have been up there. So I had that in mind, and I sort of did try and really picture a bit of a Corumba as I was writing the book. My family and I, when we moved from Brisbane to Townsville, we had driven up and we had done a very long, slow drive over sort of 10 days or 2 weeks sort of thing, because we had the young children, and stopped and spent a few days in various spots along the Queensland coast. And we spent just one night at this caravan park. We had a really long drive. I can't remember where from, maybe from like Rockhampton to Bowen or something. And there was nowhere to stay except for this one place. And it was on the coast, and it was a caravan park. And that's the caravan park I pictured when I was writing the caravan park that's in the book. And it was on that sort of mud flatty sort of beach. I remember we went with the kids for the evening to sort of pick out the mud flats and look at the little crabs and collect sort of rocks and things. And they had a bistro, and I was very much just like, this is it. And we stayed in a little cabin, and there were people there with their camper trailers and whatnot. That was what I pictured when I wrote the caravan park that's in The Drowning Girl.
Tell me about Nate, your protagonist. Now, it's hard to talk about him and his backstory without giving too many plot spoilers away, but he's obviously a damaged man who has a lot of unresolved childhood trauma. Where did your inspiration for Nate come from?
Oh, Nate. I do like him. Poor sod. Yeah, he does. Yeah, he's got a little bit of background trauma, don't we all? Yeah, it's a little bit of a flawed character, but I feel that they're sort of the best ones to read about. And really, the idea for Nate came from really the story. I had the idea for this little fishing town and this really morbid tradition that they have and this morbid festival that they run each year. So that came first, and the setting came first. And then I needed a character that was going to be able to take us through this story. And I did the same thing with The Whispering. I like to come up, after I've got that spark of an idea and I've got a setting, I like to come up with my character next. And I like to think of or come up with a person that is the worst person for that situation. So someone who's really going to struggle, because it's not particularly fun to read about a character who's breezing through the situation and everything just falls in their lap and ends out perfectly. And so I like to come up with characters that I know that in that particular situation, they're going to have a lot of difficulties for whatever reason. And usually, you know, you have to weave things into that character's past in order to make them struggle throughout the story. So whether it be Callum in The Whispering had a lot of like physical issues that limited the situation that he was in, the sort of wet cyclonic rainforest. Nate has some sort of psychological issues and phobias that he's battling with, and being in Port Flinders is sort of bringing all those feelings back up and sort of dragging them up for him. And being sort of like in this town that's sort of based around the water, and everything in Port Flinders is very sort of water orientated, so he's struggling with a few things mentally there rather than the physical challenges that Callum had a lot of in my first book. I do like to pick my characters because I like to pick people that are going to end up as poor sods that are just going to be really, that are going to find the whole situation really hard, and then they'll flounder for a bit and muddle around for a bit, but hopefully at some stage find their feet and their footing and be able to figure out what's going on and get their head around things. But my characters have pretty much always come out of the fact that I want to write about someone who's struggling in that situation. So I come up with the person who's almost the worst person to deal with the scenario that I've come up with.
Yeah, I find that really fascinating, because for someone who clearly is in Port Flinders under duress, it doesn't take Nate long to start digging around into the town's history and secrets, right?
Oh, no, he's a bit of a nosy Parker in that respect. yeah, he sort of likes to know what's going on and isn't afraid to sort of ask the questions and poke around and sort of always has his ear to the ground.
Yeah, quite brave, actually.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah, I thought he was quite courageous, despite his limitations. I thought he
Yes.
was quite courageous. So, Veronica, about midway through the book, there's a plot development that literally made me go, wait, what? And I had to go back and reread a couple of sections to realize what you'd done. Very clever, I must say, which then made me wonder if you plot your books out or whether this was a development that happened as you were writing.
I am a very enthusiastic plotter. I just cohesively plot. I love it. I love it so much. So I tried to pants or just, write without a plot a few times before I wrote The Whispering. I think I have about three failed novel attempts in the sort of proverbial bottom drawer. They're not even full novels. I got to about the 20,000 word mark. So I only wrote a snippet of each of these three books and then went, no, I don't know what's happening or where I'm going. It's not really the story I want to tell. And then I was listening to some interviews by some authors that I really admire, and they were plotters. They were all plotters. And I was like, oh, I'm going to try this plotting business. And so I plotted The Whispering and I loved it. And I actually found the process of plotting incredibly enjoyable. It's very cathartic. Like I just feel like this, I can make a big sigh at the end of it. So I plotted The Drowning Girls as well. I'm very much a plotter and I love reading books with twists. I think a lot of us do. And so I like to put twists in. And I think plotting helps me with sort of spacing out the big plot developments and making sure that I'm drip feeding bits of information and that, if I am having a few twists and turns in the novel, that they're not all clustered together and that they are sort of in those big major plot beats, like the midpoint, for example, or maybe at the climax or something like that. And so I do, yeah, I think plotting helps me get sort of that flow of the story a bit better rather than you feeling like things are maybe sludgy and draggy for a really long time, and then a lot happens, and then it's sort of sludgy again. So it helps me sort of, I think, get the peaks and valleys of the story right.
Yeah, fantastic. So the ending wasn't what I imagined it was going to be at all. Hearing that you plot, you always knew how it was going to end. And did you think that that was going to be satisfying or surprising, or how did you feel about the ending?
I love the ending. I love the ending. I did plot it and I planned that ending and it was okayed by my agent said he really liked it and my publishing editors were on board with the ending. And so it was, I think it's a bit of an unexpected ending. Not an ending that I think people are going to feel cheated or anything like that by, because there's nothing worse, I think, as a reader than getting to the end and being like, what? That's not right. So I think the sort of, the whodunit mystery is there and is, it's very satisfying, I think, the reveal at the end for that as to who sort of the main culprit is behind everything and what's been going on. But then there is this sort of cheeky little sort of twist right at the very end that I snuck in there, and I did always want that in there. And I think it's something that people wouldn't have seen coming and a bit, unexpected.
Veronica, if there was one thing you would like readers to take away from this book, what would it be?
Oh, that's a great question. I think it is. I wanted to write something that was a little bit fresh and a little bit different from the stock standard sort of Aussie crime novel that we see a lot of. We're very fortunate in that respect. We have a lot of fabulous crime writers that have come out of the woodworks, and everyone's capturing the landscape, the various landscapes through our country gloriously on the pages. And I wanted to write something that is a little bit different and might hopefully stand out from the crowd and sort of make people sit up and pay attention and make people remember it. So I've gone for a landscape or a part of our country that's not overly explored in literature. I did that with my first book also being in the rainforest. But I also love this sort of noir feeling and this idea of I want my readers to sit there reading the book and is this really happening? Do people actually believe in whatever this legend is? And is that real? Is that what's the culprit and what's behind it all? Or is there something else that's going on that's also quite sinister? And so I love that idea of having that sort of unknown element in my books and having readers really doubt the reality of what's going on in the pages of the book. I really was hoping that both my books sort of offer a bit of a fresh spin on the Australian crime genre, and they sort of add a little bit of an extra element to that.
Yeah, they absolutely do. You've done a brilliant job. Veronica, as we've already mentioned, the last few years have been life-changing for you on many fronts. But are there things that you know now about being published that you didn't know before and that have surprised you?
There's definitely things that you go, oh, hang on, is that how it works? One of the biggest, most pleasant things that's come out since being published is the glory of seeing other people comment on your book on social media or seeing a review of it in, a paper or a magazine or wherever, and hearing other people's thoughts about your writing. And that is one of the most delightful things, I think, as a debut author, was just the most unexpected thing. The first time I, it was maybe a few weeks before Whispering came out, and I saw this post that Bookstagrammer had posted about my book. It was the first time I saw a picture of my book that someone else had taken, not me. And they had all these delightful things to say about it, and it was the most humbling experience and just utterly delightful. I just honestly, you can't sort of put that into words how wonderful it feels to see other people enjoying your book and saying such nice things. So that's definitely one of the things that has surprised me the most. One of the other big things that's really surprised me is the amount of people involved in getting your book out to the world. They sort of always say it takes a village to raise a baby, and I kind of think it's the same with a book. Like, it's just, I always just thought, oh, it's just, you, the writer, and then you have someone edit it, and then it's sort of spat out into the world. But there's a whole team, you have a publicist and a marketing campaign manager, and you have your publisher, and then you have multiple editors and proofreaders, and you've got literary agent maybe, and you've got cover designers, and it's just endless. And the number of people that sort of champion your book along is really, really warming and shocking at the number of people that are required to bring a book out into the world, not to mention things like the booksellers that are, they're really taking a leap of faith, particularly with a debut author, in buying in with your book, and then they're sort of selling it in their store. They're sort of they're taking a risk, taking a chance on you, I guess.
No, I love that. Thank you so much for sharing. That's beautiful. Veronica, you might know that there are a lot of writers that listen into this podcast, and I wondered if, for those who aren't published yet, if you had some tips to offer.
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't get enough of these when I was unpublished. I think one of my big tips is, well, I have two. One I think people may have heard before, and that is to not be too disheartened by your sort of early attempts at writing that might not be so good. So I remember distinctly the moment I decided to sit down and write. I had just one child. I just returned to work part-time, and it was nighttime. My husband was going to watch the footy, which didn't interest me. And I was like, oh, what am I going to do? Our daughter's asleep, and, I didn't feel like watching telly or anything. So I decided I'll write. And I have no recollection of thinking of writing prior to that, but presumably I had been thinking about it subconsciously or something. Anyway, I sat down to write that night and I loved it. I really loved it. I started writing this just little scene I had in my head, and I sat down then every night for months after that writing this story that honestly I thought I was going to be Australia's next big storyteller. Fortunately, I had to put the writing aside for a number of months. We moved house and we had a few things going on, and I was always thinking about the writing though, and then I came back with some fresh eyes and I read it, and oh my word, was it appalling. Utterly appalling. I should have burnt the laptop then and there. And it was just so mismatched to how I had felt. Like, the process of writing had been such a glorious thing. I had loved it so much. I felt so passionate about it that I couldn't believe that what I had wrote was actually really, really bad. So I fortunately didn't let myself get discouraged. I held on to the feeling of writing and how I had loved it. And so I threw myself into honing the craft and learning how to write well. And I did everything I could. I fully immersed myself in it. It would have been every single day, podcasts, author interviews, listening to when I was walking or shopping and or driving the car. I was, on my lunch breaks, I was reading blogs by authors. I was borrowing books from the library on the craft of writing. Then I started buying them. And then I started dabbling in online courses. And then I fell down the rabbit hole of online courses and did about 100. And so I think one of the big things is not to be discouraged that your early attempts are not great. I entered a lot of short story competitions that I never heard back from. So persist. If you love it, carry on. And then I think my other piece of advice is to really sort of, if you want to become, if you're just writing for the sake of writing because you love writing, that's okay and continue. But I think if you really do want to get published and you want to sort of get maybe potentially have a bit of a career change with your writing, that you do need to take yourself seriously as a writer, even in those early days before you're published. And I did do that. So I set myself word targets so that I would actually get the manuscript finished within a reasonable time. I didn't want to be one of these people that took 5 or 10 years to write my first book. So I set myself this, it was 1,000-word limit every day I had to reach, and I made sure I did it, which is how I wrote The Whispering in sort of 3 months. And I started exploring social media. I wasn't a social media person prior to all this, but I knew that you sort of had to dive, well, I didn't have to, but that it was, you know, a good thing to dive into that world. Mm-hmm. As an author. So I started sort of dabbling there. And I did things like started looking into website designers. I got some professional headshots taken. And I had a very sort of like a sort of Excel spreadsheet with all the different publishers and, you know, when their submission dates were. And same with the literary agents, you know, so that I could have a bit of a plan for the future as to, okay, you know, in March and April next year, I'll be able to submit to these people. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, later on in the year, this group are open so I can submit to them. And so I had a real plan. I took myself quite seriously as a writer, despite the fact that I wasn't published at the time. And so I'd really encourage people to do that rather than this sort of, oh, I want to write a book, but I don't have the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, really, honestly, I think the thing is that nobody cares if you publish a book or if you write a book except for you. You're really probably the only person who it really means a lot to. And so I think you have to sort of take that onus yourself to do it.
Yeah, yep. Absolutely right. And thank you so much for sharing such fabulous tips. I'm sure listeners are going to be truly interested in learning mm-hmm. how you did it and perhaps put those tips into practice for themselves. So, Veronica, what's next for you? Are you working on book number 3? Is it already in the bag? What's happening with book number 3?
It is in first draft process at the moment. Not too long after we wrap up here, I'm going to be behind the computer dabbling away when Bubs has her nap. So I am contracted to write a third book, which is incredibly exciting. And so my publisher knows about my idea and they're happy for me to go for it. They're really excited. So I'm writing it at the moment. It's due towards the sort of tail end of the year to be handed in. And then it will be getting published probably about 12 to 18 months from now. We're sort of looking at bringing it out into the world then. So I'm incredibly excited. It's another crime novel or a bit more maybe of a thriller sort of genre, and it'll have a slightly different feel. My first two books were sort of set in these almost like little backwater towns, mm-hmm. and this one isn't. And I also have a female protagonist this time around, which I'm so excited to write a woman lead. I just can't wait. I'm loving it. So I'm not quite halfway through the first draft at the moment. So I'm diligently plodding away at it every day.
Fantastic. I love it. And Veronica, mm-hmm. if listeners wanted to learn more about you and your books, where can they find you?
Yes, so they can jump online. My website is veronicalando.com. That's probably the first and best place to head to. Otherwise, I am on Instagram at Veronica Lando Author, and I'm also on Facebook as well, Veronica Lando Author there too.
Oh, that's brilliant. Veronica, I can't tell you what a thrill it's been to chat with you today about The Drowning Girls. Thank you so much for joining me on Talking Aussie Books today.
Oh, Claudine, thank you so very much for having me. It's been my absolute pleasure.
That's a wrap, folks. If you enjoyed this podcast episode, please drop me a line via my webpage at claudinetonellis.com, via Instagram, Facebook or Twitter. Alternatively, consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or Google Podcasts. Until next time, happy reading.